Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by bellacatering.com.au. Guys, Bella Catering, one of Sydney's best catering companies, now exclusively clamped down into home delivery during the midst of COVID-19. We're on the precipice in New South Wales and Sydney area, lucky enough to not be completely locked down just yet. So if you're going to have people over at your house, why bother cooking? It sucks. So get Bella Catering. Get some delicious food. At least let that help you get through, months worth of face-to-face catch-ups with folk. And that is what you can do. You can jump onto bellacatering.com.au. They're great people. Glenn and Maria, thank you so much. They've been such an integral part in us bringing you the show during this lockdown, and we appreciate them very much. I hope you're enjoying All the President's Men. We have another banger of an episode for you. If you haven't listened yet, go back and listen to John Borston, the assistant to Alan J. Pakula. Welcome to the show. Let's do it.
The moment, the time I got the call about 9 a.m. on Saturday morning, June 17th.
That's good.
No one flashed a message to me, this is going to be one of the most important days of your life.
I was in the office that day, and I saw all this commotion around the city desk on this Saturday morning. Went to find out what it was, and there was this moment in history that became known as Watergate.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Today, I've got one of my newest and favoritest people. I know that doesn't actually make sense in the English language, but you'll understand as the introduction grows. This incredible woman is a producer of independent features like The Last Time You Had Fun, Lake Los Angeles, No Light and No Land Anywhere, has programmed the Bentonville, the LA, Slam Dance and Sundance film festivals at different points, is the co-host of a terrific show called Who Shot Ya? And I met her during a hilariously awesome Cinephile game night where we both crashed and burned really early after probably much more expectations of our success than we really earned basically at the end of the night. But watching her and her great co-host Ify Nwadwe on together, and watching my guest watch Ify vamp because he had no clue what the answer was maybe one of my favorite things of the whole year. Maybe like this, in this garbage fire of a year, it was such joy. And I thought, A, I have to get both of those guys at different times onto my show. B, I want to become their friend. And C, it was just joyful. And it's something that now, since I've recommended that Cinephile game night for folks who just miss it, just go along and watch, and just watch Drea's face when Ify's answering the question. That's enough. Welcome to All the President's Minutes, Drea Clark. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, new friend. that game was a fun experience. I do enjoy showing the flexibility of my face in various stages of incredulous to disparaging when I'm looking at Ify. It is probably not a hard year to be a highlight for someone, but it still means a lot that you say that. So thank you.
Oh, well, look, it certainly was. It's a lot of fun. And I think those ones, you know, we're all firing. We're all movie nerds. And there's some of those games that I think sometimes the faster they go and the less weird they get, it kind of is a bit rote. Like it's just going through the motion.
Yes.
So the more that the weirdness comes out, or the more that someone's completely stumped and they have a name on the edge of their tongue and they're like, I can't get this out of my brain right now. And later on, either in this game or tonight, I'm going to wake up in a cold sweat and remember that person who stumped me. They're the fun moments, and just watching people fall apart and trying to keep composed and then completely falling apart is the great fun of all of the Cinephile game nights, but particularly ours. So it was a lot of fun.
Truly. Yeah, it was a nice relief that I had worried of, ooh, are there going to be these high pressure moments? But the minute I realized that I was just going to be a C student in this, the pressure was off. I was like, oh.
There's such comfort in being average.
Yeah.
I'm in.
none of this is on my shoulders. That's fine.
I did the same thing with my best friend, Maria Lewis, who was and former host of Josie and the Podcats, our limited series. And Maria was just like, she was kicking goals. And I'm like, man, you just take it, girl. You kill it.
She was amazing. Yeah. No.
Her depth of knowledge of Bruce Willis VOD films on Netflix was almost Billy Ray level. So it was very, very impressive. Very impressive indeed.
And when do you get to flex that? Never. Never. Ever like, do you know at least 35 Bruce Willis films? No one. No one ever asks you that.
No, but what happens is, because we at one point in time lived together, when she would be watching something terrible on Netflix, I now regret how many times I berated her for like, why are you watching this? It's garbage. Yep. Stop. Just stop watching this. In Cinephile Game Night, you are just, you're stacking up, you're stacking the deck. You're ready to go.
Well, I'm always available to be a mediocre member of somebody's team.
Oh, me too, for that matter. thank you so much for doing this show. You guys on your show cover a whole range of different topics, a whole range of different subjects, a whole range of like games and new films and old films and recommendations and all those sorts of things. But today I'm just putting you smack bang in the middle of one of the greatest scenes of one of the greatest American movies. And you are putting a microscope under an Academy Award nominated performance with Jane Alexander as the bookkeeper and Dustin Hoffman. You as a person, and because of the Sundance connection, what's your relationship with this movie, particularly All the President's Men? Is a movie that you're fond of?
I love the Sundance connection. I will say it is, it's funny looking back at older Robert Redford movies, and he's just such a handsome man. It's stupid. Like, it's this thing of,
he's wearing corduroy, and he makes you want to wear corduroy, which is
not just corduroy, Blake, an entire corduroy suit, you know? And it looks good on him. Yeah. His face is ridiculous. My relationship with this film is that I saw it 20 years ago, however old I am, basically when I was in university.
Yes.
And I remember studying it. I think it's a good film class movie for a lot of people, because there is a lot to dig into in case someone in the future wanted to make a really elaborate podcast where they like went minute by minute, you know, or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember seeing it then. And I've also always been someone with a strong enough political streak or interest or conviction that I was intrigued by that. So I was brought into parts of the story that I think some of my classmates or fellow viewers at that time, when you're like in your early 20s and kind of an idiot, no matter who you are, were a little distanced from. Rewatching it, it was interesting because, you know, I see so a lot of the films I focus on, especially, are by first time filmmakers.
Yes.
And so a lot of those are films based on real life. Obviously, in those cases, much more like small, like, oh, my first love versus, oh, the real life book that I wrote about breaking down the Watergate story as a reporter for the Washington Post. We don't all have the same real lives. But it made me realize, oh, this has elements that I hadn't thought of when I first saw it, which is so often you see these real life based stories and you'll make a note on it if it's in the script or in the edit to the filmmaker of like, this might be a step too far, or is this twist necessary because you might be losing audience or momentum or urgency. And the feedback is always, but that's what happened. Like, that's what really happened. Yes. And in All the President's Men, in rewatching it and thinking of like my younger, really political mind, and I'm sure I was taking some kind of poli-sci courses that were digging into similar moments in history. Yes. So I was like, yes, I want every moment in time. And this one, I was like, oh yeah. Oh, they left it all in there. I'm sure they're, do you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of dumb audiences that, and I say this, not, I would love to come on your podcast and be like, first things first, it's a terrible movie. But no, I mean, it's brilliant and I loved it and was so happy to revisit it. But that was one of the things that stood out to me in my later viewing of, oh, because I'm also viewing it as someone who's living in 2020 America and watching, there's so obviously, you've touched on a lot of these, there's so many horrifying similarities, but there's also so many things of, oh, we as an American populace did not learn many of these lessons, like the idea of like history repeating itself. There's so many on the nose moments in this that it's like, what are you kidding? Like that I had even forgotten. So that is a very long answer to try and explain my time traveling mindset, both first and then this particular rewatch. But yeah, man, it's food for thought, this one.
It's also so funny that you say that, Dre, because you know, your instinct is you as a person who's programming and has that insight and you're helping a young filmmaker, it's we've geared ourselves into, if you don't capture people's attention and there is dead air, much like sometimes on a podcast, if there is dead air and we are not like unpacking it, the attention span is microcosmic. Like microscopic. It is not going to happen for you if you leave too much dead air or the scene that you're unfolding, it has to be doing something really, there has to be a turbulent emotion, has to be a huge reveal, has to be something that like gives people something. And I feel like in this movie, it completely is counterintuitive to all of your contemporary instincts, because even on, you know, things like Sorkin's The Newsroom and stuff like that, which is a sort of a contemporary text, leaves no air. There's no air. It's just all fast talk, all story, all drama. As fast as we can say these words to you, we're going to get them out. There will be no spaces. And even in the minute as we were watching, you know, taking my own notes for it again, I love personally, and of this whole era, unanswered questions. I love it. Like a question that is asked and then there's dead air and you're watching Dan Alexander's face and you're watching Hoffman's shuffle paper and look and go, how do I recover from a non-answer at this moment? And it's all these counterintuitive things, I think, but funnily enough, and this is, you know, with great movies like A Maniac Like Me, who's done Heat and now All the President's Men, these movies fly for me. Like there are movies that are 90 minutes that feel like you are being punched in the face every 10 seconds. Like, oh, this could not be taking any longer. You're looking at your watch and you can't believe it's only got a 90-minute running time. Whereas like this movie, over 2 hours, nearly 2 hours, 45, you are just breezing through it. Like it feels like, well, I'm even watching this now. We're nearly at 80 minutes in. I'm like, oh my God, we haven't even gotten to some juicy bits yet.
There's
juicy bits to come.
Well, paralleling that with the idea of programming. So programming for film festivals is, you know, selecting which films are going to be shown. And you're looking both for what can I bring to the unique audience? What am I fulfilling in terms of mission of organization? But then you're also really hoping to launch new talent, ideally sell the film and have a film be a tremendous success. But also, like I said, a lot of my work has been done with first-time director. So like I program Lynn Shelton's first film. I program Sean Baker's first film, Drake Doremus. Like there's a lot of filmmakers that you're looking at their work and it's not just like, you probably didn't see the film I programmed of it, but are they going on? And in that, what I'm always looking for and what I'm always encouraging emerging filmmakers is you cannot say enough about POV, like point of view.
Yes.
That what a director's perspective is doing in terms of honing in every department, utilizing the script, utilizing performances, utilizing everything, that's the director's job, right? That's all they're doing. They're answering 8 million questions every day to convey this POV. And I think with All the President's Men, and this scene's a great example of it, of what you're getting in the choices, for every movie, every step of the way, how are you presenting this information? Like, are you giving me like the generic coverage of, all right, we're going to start in a two shot and then a one shot, and then it's going to get closer and closer, and there's a master, like there's the obvious. And then there's the, like, we could dig into this scene for sure. And I'm very excited to, but the other part of why I liked this scene in the microcosm of this film as well, what stood out to me this time in All the President's Men, in the eyes of someone who's, because I'm not a film reviewer, like we talk about films on my podcast, but I'm not a critic.
Yes.
What I'm always looking for, it's a different angle in than a lot of people would have, I think. And so with All the President's Men and rewatching it, it's this thing of what's really interesting. It's a movie that the big story that's happening is like the D storyline. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like the presidency and Nixon and his reelection committee and what they're doing to hold on to that presidency by all costs.
Yes.
That normally would be the A storyline, right? Normally you'd be creeping around, you'd be following Segretti, you'd be watching all of the like the Canuck letter and all of this stuff. This movie's like, no one's really interested in that. What they want to see, they want to see people doing homework, you know, like, so they made like making it about the journalist, like that's a POV. And
yes.
And a lot of people could adapt the same exact source material and been like, cool, you guys are like the bookends of the story, right? Like we're going to start with Woodstein and then we'll end with that. But like, then we'll get into the good stuff. And this movie's always like, no, first and foremost, it's how they're doing this homework, this journalistic homework. And this scene is a great example of, you have like, your story would normally be, oh, there's this woman whose home is being intruded on by this strange man who's kind of weaseled his way in and like has just like taken over her coffee machine. And you know what I mean? There's like an invasive thing. Like normally the side of
40 of this person's cigarettes.
Yes. The sympathy you would normally have in this scene would just be 100% on her. And so the POV, what I was almost just called him Alan, you know, like we're on a first name basis. What the director was bringing to this and how he frames everything, it gives us that POV. It gives us that directive. And I found that such an interesting way to look at it in terms of like always like, oh, everything about this concentrates on the part you wouldn't naturally like concentrate on.
I also think there's just by coincidence at the time that we're talking about this at the time, which is very close to the time that people are going to hear it. There's been some dialogue with like, you know, who are the best current like film critics in the discourse, like, you know, either pros or indies who talk about film form. And I think that that's something that you dig into probably more innately, Dre, in your job, because you're like, the POV is the form. You know, if you're seeing repetitive formal notes and it's like, it must be like a chord structure in a song. You're like, oh, every song sounds the same. Like all these pop songs have got the same structure. And you're looking for exactly what about that formal construction is unique. And if the voice is unique and if the way that it's structured, something will leap out at you. Like a Sean Baker or a Lynn Shelton, like they pop, you'd go, oh, hello. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. There's a voice here. There's a voice of someone that is giving me something different. There are obviously rules that people adhere to, but very much that there's a unique voice here. And I think that that's what Pakula does so beautifully, is that, like you said, the command of the perspective of this movie to just never take you away from these guys, and the inference like of the entire massive, huge machine of American politics that is all working on the outside, that's on the outside. And even in The Master, the wide shot, as you said, that sometimes would have happened way earlier, not 6 minutes into this scene, but probably way earlier in this scene, the establishing wide, is this incredible surveillance-tinged thing that is just the one inference that like, hey, everything that these guys are doing, probably people know about, whether that's the FBI or the government, or everyone's being watched, everyone's in danger, but I don't know if these guys can plug up all the holes in their sinking ship. before this thing gets, you know, before this thing gets sunk. So yeah, it's really interesting. But I that's one interesting thing talking to you about, like, you're just looking at visual cinematic language as like your first gateway in sometimes, I guess, is a nice way to do it. Cause I think too many people sometimes focus on the story, and this moment could be all story, but it's actually all the mood. It's all the tone. It's all the light. It's everything about how this is constructed.
But the story, it's all like, it's so symbiotic, right? If you weren't having a story that was having these guys, you know, writing on every imaginable napkin scrap that he can get, and do you know that had these choices, or that were following every thread? Like, again, if this had been presented to me right now, if this was not part of American history, if Watergate was nothing and it was someone's fictional creation, and I was handed this script, I would be like, oh, I'm really excited about it. Now let's dig into basically the beginning of Act Three onward, because there starts to be so many, it's a weird thing, because I have such respect for moviegoers, because I am a moviegoer.
Yes.
But I also know what people are getting from film is at such different levels. And sometimes it's like, okay, you're up your own ass with this. Make it more explainable, or like more easily comprehensible to any viewer.
Yes.
Because what do you get from being, you know, like, pretentious about it? And so, not that I think this is pretentious, but there is like stuff that really happened with this investigation, with the post-investigation, that if I was looking at it on a script level as a work of fiction, I'd be like, okay, stop. Who are we trying to implicate? Like,
too many names. I do not. And,
right?
And now, in the countless times I've viewed this, it's funny talking to people. It's like, the first time through, they say too many names that you can't follow. And one of the arts of this movie is that by the end, you've got enough. Like, there's enough. And then when you go back, you're like, oh, they say Magruder. And they say, you know, they say Liddy. And who is Liddy? I want to know who Liddy is and what he's done. And it's just one of those weird things that, like, on a script level, I imagine you're like, wait, stop. You've said 14 names here. We don't know what happens to at least 11 of them. You have to give me more closure than that if I'm reading this as a consumer. But yeah, no,
it's interesting in the story of it, of if it was fictionalized, you know, they're literally, no matter what you're watching, it could be like a story about ponies. Actually, there's a whole brony thing, so that's probably not a great example.
Don't go down the
brony. The whole thing of, right, don't bring that up. But like, the whole idea, everybody's like, can we make this sexier? Like, the idea of follow the money is sort of sexy. If like, oh, are we going to end up with like really wealthy, really whatever? But it's never even that, right? Like, there's all these intangibles of, wait, why? I learned this whole person just so I would find out about another person to get to another person. Like, and so it's convoluted in a way that real life very much is. So those things are also of interest. That's maybe more my producer brain of, okay, nope, I'm okay smart. I mean, I'm a mediocre cinephile player, but I'm okay smart. However, I need this taken like a second. But there's also then, to their credit, of, no, don't dumb things down. People will get what they get.
Yeah.
And you take out, and that's where the POV comes in to fill in the rest. I may not, when I was 20 or whatever, tracked every name they were saying and like, wait, who are we? What are we even trying to find out?
Yes.
But I knew who I was following. I knew the urgency of it. I knew the intent. And then I was getting all of those other layers of things, of how these two guys have their different approaches and how them working together, like, even starts to refine each other. So the scene that we're discussing, which I love for a lot of reasons, the minute in a scene, but to me, it's this hilarious moment of, oh, this is where I think Bernstein is most trying to emulate Woodward's approach, because he's like, oh, I'm going to take a seat, right? He's like walky and twitchy, and he's the guy who pushes Ned Beatty, and like he's like his like hands on hips guy. And this is a scene
where the guy's flirting with a secretary who's just like this. Doors are shut.
I mean,
like, he's still here, and she goes, I'm glad.
She's my hero. I give that face a lot. Yes. But like, so this is his scene where he's like, okay, what would Woodward do? What's my bracelet? WWWD. And then he's like, okay, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to drink coffee and I'm going to just like talk to her. But he also has his Bernstein of the like smoking nonstop and drinking coffee nonstop. It's this funny hybrid of but of how these journalists who are
watching him bubble, also, you're watching him wrestle with it. Like that's so great in this minute. He's like, especially when she doesn't answer, he's like, oh, just ignore what I'm doing here, just for my memory. Because just little like things, those ticks. And I think that that's what's magic, because it's not effortless. Like when you go back, if you go all the way back to that wonderful courtroom scene with Woodward, like his true technique, his true value as a journalist may not necessarily be sometimes like structuring a piece, but he can extract information out of a source like blood from a stone instantaneously. Like he will get it out. Something about people wanting to talk to him also helps. He makes corduroy suits look good, you know, in the romance of this movie. But that there's that lawyer spilling the beans to him and just saying more and implicating more and saying all this weird stuff. And he's just like, he doesn't even realize that he's just blah, 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 blah. It's just falling out of his face. And there's Redford's Woodward just picking it all up and then taking it back to Harry. And then eventually, you know, starting to figure out how this thing works. And that's what I love about this moment. Exactly. As you said, this entire scene is, and the next one's more overt when they're in Woodward's house and they're actually starting to strategize together. But this is the moment where you're like, actually, if I play this like me, I'm out the door. And and you're watching in real time Hoffman make that feel like it's completely spontaneous, completely just instinct. I've got to go this direction. It's one of the magic things about this scene.
It's also such a great indicator of, this is a film that takes advantage of people's innate knowledge of how humans read each other.
Yes.
And so, like, obviously no one other than Robert Redford and sort of Brad Pitt look like that. But, like, the actual Woodward, handsome enough guy, and the actual Bernstein, nervous enough guy. Like, it fits what that is. And the idea of that their skills as journalists have been so influenced of how they're perceived by the world.
Yes.
Like the Woodward is comfortable just asking people things because people are always comfortable having that guy around. Like this is a movie where we watch just legions of white men making all of the decisions and calling all of the shots and begging women for information so they can keep doing it, but then not crediting them in any way. But you know, the other, even within the white guy tier, there's the idea of like, yes, is this like waspy?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The attractive, calm guy who's only been on the paper for 9 months, you know, that of course he's like moving up the staircase, surely, because that's who moves up the staircase, right? Like it's part of his whole, how he gets things out of people is the absolute lack of fear. Like, of course they're going to tell me, I mean, you see what I look like, right? Like I'm the guy, I'm always the guy. Whereas Bernstein, even in the same pot, is like, oh, I'm grinding more and I make people a little nervous. I'm a little Jewish. Like there's things that he's battling against societally that Woodward is not. It affects how they do their investigations.
And it's even in the flirtation. So that great scene on the Q Hotel where he's flirting with the secretary earlier, he's just right out on Front Street. She's like, I heard about you. And he's like, what do you mean? And he's, what do you mean is the posture's different. He's just right out on Front Street. Yes, I'm a sex fiend. Yes, you know it. I cycle around Washington. This is what I do. It's fine. Whereas like the fearlessness comes with the confidence of like, I'm just a middle American guy. You see what you get. Yeah. Do it. And both those guys like get that essence so much. And like Hoffman, obviously at the time, you know, stud at the time, movie actor, he's there. He can bring all of that to the Bernstein bit, as, you know, probably Bernstein would like to think of himself as a Hoffman at that time, as anyone would, right? Like have these guys play you if you can. But but yeah, I think that's so funny that like in this moment, you're watching a guy go, I can't do any of the things that my natural instincts tell me to do. And, yeah. And you know, I don't know if you've had those moments. I've had them at different jobs. I've had them at different work. It's like, there's a flood of emotion and there's a flood of instinct that happen with something in your life and it's there and you're right in front of it. And it's like, how I react to this next could be how Blake normally reacts. It's like you talk about yourself nervous. It's like how Drea is going to react in the next second is going to be this, like your internal narrator. And then you're like, no, I'm going to take a tact on this. And it may not be your instinct, but it's like, that is the best course of action. Cause for that second, you catch yourself in slow motion and go, no, I'm not going to go this way. I'm going to go somewhere other way.
But that's the growth of things, right? Like, yeah. I think, like, I'm probably repeating myself a little, but, you know, there's that wonderful moment early on where Woodward's been typing things. He notices Bernstein keeps taking his stuff and is essentially correcting it. Sure. Bernstein points out, well, my version's better because I led with this. I said this right away. It's structured, whatever. And then that moment when Woodward, instead of the normal reaction of defensiveness, of, you know, whatever, I'm class president my whole life, he instead is like, you're right, your version's better. Like the teachable moment of that, yeah. To me, this moment with Bernstein is the reflection of that, of he has been watching someone else's investigative style, someone else's questioning, reasoning, the tone they take with people. And this is when he decides, like you say, like he has his first instinct and then he thinks, how am I going to grow in my craft? I'm going to try this tactic. And it's not a hugely different. He's asking questions, but you know, he's for all of his like hyped up caffeine and chain smoking, he's calmer. Like he's nervous, but he's taking his time with it. He's letting her sit with it. And he needs to, because the other part of this scene that's set up so well, or I keep saying scene, but again, our 1 minute is.
You're allowed to say scene. We're cheating liberally. This is what
I'm happened. Sure.
No, but as long as we will tackle the actual minute in a moment, but I think I'm enjoying the intersections of what we're talking about. So yeah, the scene itself, you're saying?
Oh, I was going to say, yeah, I don't want to like throw off the order of things, but there's also like the framing of it, the idea of this dialogue is done as a dialogue. It's a one shot of him, a one shot of her. They are on different sides of the frame. They are, you know, like we're not close in on them. We're right. Back enough. We're the third person in this room, right? It's this triangle seating and we are the third person watching these two people. They're completely separate. And so then there's also, that's what I felt like the microcosm of how I see this story. Normally the big story would be the actual Watergate and you know, like all of the trickliness of getting in on that election. And then the journalism would be down here. Yes. And this moment, it's like normally all of the story would be give me the names, give me the whatever. And instead we're focusing on, we are watching this woman eke out in the smallest ways information. And there's no manipulation of it. She is in control of this conversation. She's leading this dialogue. Which differs from the follow-up exchange they have when Woodward is with him. In this moment, she is much, like I was saying before, like normally this man has burst into this woman's home. Normally our sympathy would all be for her, but she's in charge of what she's wanting to release. And there's also in her performance, it's like this limited dialogue. It's these pauses, but there's a sense of right and wrong. And that keeps coming across in a lot of different performances, particularly with the people who do give them information. Yes. It's this just black and white, right or wrong element. And I love it. I can't remember. No, I think it's after our minute when she says that it would be great if you could get Mitchell.
it's just after us. Yeah.
It's just after. Yeah.
It's just after.
But she's like cooking up for that. So, but this part, he's asked for this, like, you know, they found out there's these 15 names and they're wondering about the amount of money. And
actually before we dive into
the
point, for folks listening at home, Drea and I've had too much fun. And we've gone So what we're going to do is you guys are going to listen along to this minute, the 78th minute, cue it up on your dial. Very fortunately, there is and should be only one version of All the President's Men out there, whether you're watching on VOD or Blu-ray. It is 1 hour, 17 minutes to 1 hour, 18 minutes, the 78th minute. This is now really the third or fourth, depending on where you sort of mark it, the third or fourth minute that's really in this scene. And we've still got a few minutes to go. And this is the... You know, this is the centerpiece of this entire film. So we're carving it up in a lot of different ways. We're going to quickly watch it / listen to it along now. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Not in one big chunk. There was a list of 15 names and the amount of money given to each person next to the name.
What happened to the list?
It was destroyed. It was the only record.
This, so don't pay any attention to this. This is just for my memory. I hate the thing that I have a very bad memory. It won't be quoted by name. In fact, we get confirmations before we print anything.
I can't be positive that that money was used for the break-in, you understand?
Yes, I do.
But people sure are worried.
Which people? Think you could help me with the disbursement of money in terms of the number of people that were involved? Just how many?
Nice. Yep.
There it is. I just want to say one factoid. There's 8 seconds between the time that she says people are worried and the time that he asks which people, and there is 8 seconds, or about 7.5, I think, if you went to it, of dead silence in that minute. And that is a cavernous hole in the center of that beautiful little interplay there. And it's probably my favorite moment, because Jane Alexander's face.
Yes.
You know, Alan Pakula, in a great little interview that I tagged on the front of the 76th episode. So if you go back, you can listen to it. It's the actual narration preamble of that episode. Pakula talking about saying, you know, going home to his wife every day when they were shooting this scene, saying, I wish I should be paying $25 a day to sit down and watch these two guys do this, because he was so impressed with her performance, Hoffman's performance. But, oh man, I've said it a couple of times, but I just feel like she's a storm. Like, there's a storm happening inside this woman, and she's so, you know, glacially perfectly composed. And it's just the way the lighting works, even though it's sort of interrogation lighting, if you like, but she's just magnificent. And I've watched this scene now. I'm already an obsessive, has watched this movie countless times. And now, in preparation for all these episodes, I've watched it again and again. And it is just, this is the scene that you, talk about teachable moments. This is a teachable scene. If you're an actor, male or female, anyone, However you define yourself, whatever pronoun you use that makes you feel comfortable, this person's performance is as good as it gets.
I agree on so many levels. It's, you know, so much of acting in people who are truly just good at their craft,
yes,
is in reaction. And what Jane Alexander's doing is she's reacting both to Dustin Hoffman, she's also reacting to her own internal thoughts. It is very, very difficult to convey. Like, just try. Please get your phone out, film yourself trying to look like you're thinking about something. Like, it is difficult to convey concern and nervousness and thinking long term. And you can look at her and she's completely still. But yes, like, a storm is good. There's so much thought going on in her head. And I also, you know, we were talking about the framing earlier. They are in an incredibly domestic looking setup. They're inside a home.
Yes.
There's like a cozy, like, there's an Afghan over the chair. Do you know what I mean? There's like ugly art on the wall, but it is also the weirdest alcove nook you've ever seen.
Yeah.
They're not in a real room. Everything about it is like, it's like, oh, these are just those weird chairs that people have next to their front door that no one ever sits in. Like, you change your shoes there, and instead
my wife's Nana has a couch in the front room of her house that I've never seen a human being sit on.
Blake, you never will. No one is meant to sit on that couch. But so they're in this area and we are creeping in on it. And we're sort of looking through the banister when it's all being set up. And it sets, we're in this woman's space. It has this domesticated feel to it. She is also like in very comfortable clothing. Her hair is down. She's not, you know, like even when they interview, Stephen Graham's character,
I've lost his name. I'll get it for you, but you're talking. Yeah, Stephen Graham's character.
Tall, handsome. Anyway, even when they interview him at home, he's in a shirt and tie. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like there's something about when they speak to women in this,
Stephen Collins, Hugh Sloan's character.
Collins, yes, yeah, Sloan.
Yeah, he's there. Stephen Graham. He's there in his tie. He's looking very, very smart. Very well applied. Yes.
Yes. Right. He just looks like, oh, you are either in finance or government. Like there's no other choice for you, man. Like in this scene, we get this woman and most of the women we see in this film are in their own homes, are in domestic settings. And she is no different, even though she's the bookkeeper. What she has access to are their finances. Like it's this very like right-brained analytical job, and you know she can obviously has so much information in her head. But what we get from this person who has cold and hard figures and facts is so much of an emotional response. And you also do have to credit the editor for that. Like to build in and cook in those 8 seconds. And that counts.
The relationship between, I mean, really Mr. Pakula and all of his team, but particularly also Robert L. Wolf. So Robert L. Wolf is the editor of this movie. He's a Peckinpah editor. So you know that he knows how to build speed, build tension, fast cut, slow-mo, all those things. And I think what is amazing is this is a guy who came in and could cut this movie this way. And in the 76th episode, you hear the great John Boorstin join us, who is Alan Pakula's assistant on set. And he talks about they structured these scenes for air. So even Robert L. Wolf's preliminary cuts, they had to go back to the drawing board and go, no, we've cut too much out. There's something that's not right. And then finding those exact moments where you give the space before you then cut to the next person. And like I said, that yawning 7.5 to 8 second gap, just to be so mercurial to like, I'm going to get that one 100th of a second or 2 100th of a second. And people who sometimes agonize over whether you're editing audio or video.
Oh yeah. Like,
sometimes really 1/10 of a second makes a massive difference. And that for just casual listeners or casual viewers might go, no, that couldn't. And you're like, yes, it actually does. And so this whole interplay is like the patience to go, we are going to go this and just tweak and tweak and tweak until it has that. I don't know. It still doesn't lose any of its momentum, which is strange, even though it is a pause in the movie. And the tone shift, because they're like, it is a big montage. Music, you know, Shire's scores popping up, doors being slammed in their faces, you know, butting their heads up against the wall again. And then now we get into this very slow moment, but it still doesn't seem to lose any steam.
But that's part of that is, you know, people talk a lot about moments that allow a film to take a breath. And I think this is one of those. Like we have been going so frenetically. We've been watching them pound the literal pavement.
Yes.
And so to have a scene where like they sit down, there's moments, it's not like a door's being shut or I'm the wrong person or whatever. I'm going to engage. I'm going to be thinking deliberately and carefully about what I say. Do you know what I mean? It is. And it's like anything else. If you go into, you know, you've watched movies, and there's some movies that do them well. Crank, great. Crank should be at level 10 the whole time, and it kind of is.
And if you like, you can't complain that Crank has got any low points.
No, it's called Crank. I mean, you knew what you were signing up for. But for most films, it's the same with songs, with literature. Like the taking a breath, you need those. You need things to have peaks and valleys. You need the different levels of what you as a viewer are doing, because even then, you know, that's when we're also collecting, we're parsing through the information we've been giving. What is he trying to get out of her? Because at this point I'm like, okay, She's a bookkeeper. What do we need from her? What's this list of names? So a lot of his questions, you're like, please answer, and then also explain what they mean. You know, like, you need a moment to sit with this stuff anyway, because this is when you turn and you are in the weeds now with information. Like, everything is just turned into that weird, you know, serial killer wall where they've, like, pictures and maps, and they've drawn, and they have string connecting one thing to another.
In the video that we're talking about is a True Detective poster, and it's one of my favorite moments in True Detective, where Russ and Cole opens his garage locker and there's this ginormous corkboard, and it's covered with things, and there's trinket and weird stuff, and you're like, this guy's insane. And that's the kind of moment you need for catharsis. But Dre, you put it better almost than anyone that I've heard here, which is, she is not only responding to the questions that he is asking her, but responding to the thoughts that she's having in her own head unprompted. Because what she does, which I love the dialogue, is she tells him there was a single list of 15 names that they were keeping for themselves. So this is where the awakening of her, like, this is actually illegal stuff going on. She says that it's there. It was the only record. And then she goes, but it was destroyed. So she starts to tell him, like, there is the thing that could basically, that is the smoking gun in this entire thing, is gone. So now we have to reverse engineer it. And also then the people are worried, and I didn't think anything was illegal going on, but, and the fact that she's said that it's destroyed is almost like a micro awakening to her. Like, oh shit. Well, if there was only one record and we destroyed it, then we don't want people to know what was happening. And so that just, there's tiny little revelations, but it's the way that she's responding and how the sentences are structured there, and figuring out, like, what is her thought versus what is her answering the question, I think is that really, like, it's such a, like, a perfect scripting character technique. Because not people don't just always answer things. They sort of want to cover their own butt, and then they want to talk themselves around. And that's such a great technique, because it's like coming at those different angles and how she's responding, and it feels so authentic and organic, because that's how the flow goes, right? You're trying to cover your own butt, essentially.
Yeah. Every interrogation they have with someone in this has shades of what is the percentage of self-protection.
Yes.
Versus the protection, or the percentage of transparency.
Yes.
Like, it's every single thing they're doing. Like, Deep Throat, self-protection's at 98%. You know what I mean? Transparent knowledge is at 2%. She is on the other end of that scale. So with all of them, you're watching how they're couched, but it's that, you know, it's something we all go through of, you can be needling something, puzzling something over. And then if you get to the stage where you say it out loud to someone, the second you say it out loud, you're like, okay, I hear that. Oh yeah, we had one list. It's been destroyed. Yeah. Am I one of the bad guys?
Yes.
Yes. Like, so, and it's couched in her performance. It's structured into the dialogue. It's a good human moment. And this is also one, you know, like, the Oscars deservedly should take a lot of heat for the idea of what has been considered historically to be a good film, to be a worthy, like, it's like how comedies are always considered lesser forms of cinema in the eyes of the Academy, which is ridiculous to anyone who's ever made a comedy or looked at comedies that have, like, just as much nuance and thought and artfulness as a drama would.
People who listen to this network know how happy we are that Josie and the Pussycats is getting its due since 2001 and people re-enjoying that movie. But, like, I think it was the minute you said that, I'm like, if you think about it, this is Spinal Tap, and you try and tell me that movie doesn't have the artistry, like, even though it is profoundly hilarious, it's like, if you tell me that movie isn't influential or worthy of recognition,
right?
It's like, are you insane? Do you know how many people have been striving for a Spinal Tap from the second it was made? Like, it has something, and, you know, Blazing Saddles, like, stop it. Just, you know, there's just some movies that are, that comedies like that, worthiness and the Oscars don't necessarily go hand in hand.
And her being nominated for Best Supporting Actress is something that could fall into that, in terms of, if you're looking at genres of, like, comedy versus drama versus whatever, and the credit they get, you're also looking at, like, quantity And so, like, the idea of screen time in this overall, for this overall film, both the percentage of time she's on, but just the amount of time she's on at all, the level of involvement she has, which is largely passive. Like,
yes.
Do you know what I mean? She's not, like, chasing stuff down. It's, but the burden of craft on her and what people are bringing, it's why it's so difficult to gauge things against each other. It's why, do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I'll pick favorites.
but it's one of those things that you go, this is one of those nominations where you're like, oh, they can find the good ones. You know, people, the Academy has seen this performance and, you know, the acting branch is massive and obviously the directing branch is pretty much next, but it's like, it's people looking at this performance going, if Jane Alexander does not knock this out of the park at the moment that it falls in this movie that is recognized as one of the best of the year, maybe one of the best of the decade, and certainly in my mind, one of the best American movies ever made, it's like, if she doesn't knock this out of the park and this whole scene doesn't have the alchemy that it has, the movie fails. Like, it's like they have to nail this scene so profoundly and perfectly and pitch perfect for the rest, for the momentum of the rest of the movie and how everything else is structured, that if they don't nail it, it sucks, but they get it. And you're like, oh, you got it. You saw yeah. how important this was. And it comes around every now and then. It's one of those things that, you know, the Oscars and just awards in general are so infuriating about, where you're like, oh, you didn't see it. And then sometimes they're like, and the best picture is Parasite. And you're like, oh my God. I can't believe it.
You saw it.
You saw what we all saw. It's just one of those things that, it's frustrating, but also, you know.
Yes.
Causes much joy.
A lot of stuff. I mean, and you could do, maybe you will, Blake. Like, don't let me sell your empire short. You could do an entire whole thing on the weird machinations and political breakdown of Oscar campaigns. But yeah, this one was a nice. I also have such a soft spot.
I'm just going to say, because Dre, you're not the first person on this show that offers me what the next show is. And I'm just telling you right now, that's not for me. I'm not in. I'm out. I'll relinquish that to award pundits and experts. If Chris Tapley is listening, that's him. Chris, we're yours, baby. I'm out.
Yeah. I'm not a good awards person in remembering them. But I do always like to hear about the underbelly political machinations of like campaigns and stuff, because it's the idea of people thinking like, oh, the Oscars, that's not like a clear merit based, there's millions of dollars that go into this, but that's a whole other, maybe for anyone who's listening can dig on that. But Jane Alexander, you have to love that her career ended up in a political element, like running, she ran under Clinton, right? The National Endowment for the Arts, and which is such a nice little like boop, like a little button on, oh, well, you may know me from All the President's Men. You may now know me as part of the Clinton administration. Twist.
I was leaving the gap there for Trey to tag that gag, and absolutely nailed it. Oh my goodness. Look, and I'm glad now that I'm talking about, you know, when you're doing this sort of thing, that it's got the award recognition, but like you said, it is a fascinating underbelly, because, you know, my favorite film, this is one of my favorites, my favorite film of all time, is Michael Mann's Heat. It has zero Academy Award nominations and wins. And The Joker had 14. You know, I just...
We'd need another hour, Blake. We need way more time.
Dre, this has been an absolute thrill talking to you. Thank you so much for flexing your amazing programming mind and your instincts for POV on one single minute of a movie rather than entire films, entire bodies of work, entire archives of people's stuff. So I just want to say thank you so much. It's been an absolute blast talking to you for the show.
This was so fun. Thank you. I'm honored that you invited me.
The honor and the pleasure, absolutely all mine. That was the incredible Drea Clark. Of course, you can find her at her great podcast, Who Shot Ya, with Ify Nwadwe, which we mentioned on the show, or on Twitter, at the Drea Clark, and on her website, DreaClark.com. Now, all that stuff is in the description of the show. Thank you very much for listening again to All the President's Minutes. It's been an absolute monster week. We have one more episode this week coming to you, and then we have another loaded week next week. Thank you to everyone for supporting, listening, sharing, anything you are doing. We appreciate it. We've got some really great stuff happening on One Heat Minute Productions, including a brand new Patreon exclusive weekly video and audio podcast coming up. More of that to come very soon. But until then, subscribe, rate, chuck us a review. We appreciate you. I am One Blake Minute on the socials at ATPM Pod for this one, oneheatminute.com. Catch you on another episode very, very soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.